Welcome to Lickin' On Leadership.
The purpose of this program is to bring to you interviews with industry leaders.
A weekly podcast bringing you leaders of the real estate and mortgage industry.
And I can't think of anyone better to join me in this role of providing this co-hosting role than one of the top leaders in our industry, and that's Mark Jones of AmeriFirst Mortgage Banking Group.
And here's the host of Lickin' On Leadership, David Lickin and Mark Jones.
I'm excited to have joining us on the Lickin' On Leadership podcast today someone who is a bit of a veteran to the mortgage industry, Jess Letterman. Jess, good to have you here with us today.
Great to be here, David.
First of all, for those that are not aware of the Mortgage Professional Handbook, this has been something that has been a staple of the industry for years, and there was an initial publication, Ken, that came out years ago, and then it has been recently updated.
Before we get to the interview, we'll have just a quick word from the sponsor that makes this podcast possible. Are you looking to reduce loan origination costs while increasing processing speed? With advanced robotic capabilities in Black Knight's Empower loan origination system, lenders can improve cycle times and lower their cost per loan. Empower's robotics can be used for automating a variety of repetitive tasks, including disclosures, third-party service orders, and much more. Learn how you can get Empower now. Visit our website at blackknightinc.com.
First of all, for those that are not aware of the Mortgage Professional Handbook, this has been something that has been a staple of the industry for years. Jess wrote the first handbook, and he was instrumental in bringing a group of us together to write the 3-volume second book. So I want to make sure we get that on the website and everyone's attention to that. Jess, it's good to have you here. And I think for those that may not know you, other than you're famous for the handbook, how did you get started in the mortgage industry?
Well, I think I got started the way that, if I had to guess, most people do, which is completely and utterly randomly. I was a music major with expensive tastes in piano, so I needed a job.
I didn't know we had that in common. I'm a vocal major as well, a music major as well, so I didn't know we had that in common. There's a lot of music folks in the mortgage industry. That's kind of surprising. Yeah.
I took the first job that was offered me, but it was I was very lucky in what that was, which was I started out in the mortgage insurance industry with PMI in San Francisco, which was a perfect place to begin back then, because not only because mortgage insurers had a national perspective, but back at that time, all the leaders in the secondary market, all the capital markets talent that would eventually move to Wall Street and the agencies later in the 1980s was all working in the mortgage industry back then. And you know, when you asked me to come on here, and I was thinking a little bit about my career, I was thinking, I got started in 1980. What was the world like, the mortgage world like in 1980? It was a world of plain vanilla 15 and 30-year mortgages and mostly strict ratio underwriting, and the only securitizations were agency, and jumbos only traded as whole loans. And, you know, it's ironic because if somebody who started out in this business 30 years later, like around 2010, might well have said, "Hey, that sounds like when I started out."
So that's true.
Sometimes in science fiction stories, right, there's some cataclysm that occurs, and all of a sudden, modern technology goes away, and we're back to without. How do you get along without electricity and modern conveniences? And you know, David, the great mortgage meltdown was a lot like that, except it wasn't the result of a national disaster. It was really reflected a failure of leadership and of learning and taking to heart the lessons of the past. And when you asked me to come on and talked about your how you were doing a series on leadership, I thought, you know, I think that's a profound point, that what we went through and what we're emerging from now was really a failure to understand leadership lessons.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think leadership is one of the biggest crises as we had that into that. And there are many aspects about that I want to get into. Excited to get your perspective. But interest rates were really high back then. I started in 1973, so I got a 7-year jump on you getting into the industry. But mortgage rates were so unusually high. Talk about that time. I'm thinking 60. I remember have a recollection of being 16, 17, 18%. Yeah, I think even did a few loans at right up against 20%.
Yeah, that's right. It was an environment that I think people who've gotten started any time in the past, better part of the past 20 years, would have a hard time understanding. And back then, in that environment, I helped to create and to lead two of the first private sector counterparts to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So this was back in the dawn of private label securitization, the first of the jumbo conduits. And, when you ask me about interest rates and the environment back then, personally, my first big break was in 1983 when PMI, that the company that I had first joined, it was part of the Sears Group. And this was back when Sears had this vision of doing everything from what they call stocks to socks. So it owned Dean Witter and Coldwell Banker and Allstate and a variety of financial companies. And so a group of us went off from PMI and created Sears Mortgage Securities Corporation. So it was really the second of the private conduits. And I was head of sales and marketing on the buy and sell side. This was, super exciting. I mean, we were going to change the world. And the only trouble was exactly the point that you brought up. Interest rates at that time, when we opened the doors, fixed rates were 14%, not quite as high as a few years in the past, but high enough. And American Savings in Stockton, they were paying up, and they were buying any of those 14% loans at the jumbo loans that were being made. They were buying. And our
Charlie Knapsole operation, boy, that brings back some memories.
That's right. And then our arch rivals, the first of the jumbo conduits, Residential Funding Corporation, they were teamed up with Solomon Brothers, and they were buying all the adjustables. And I figured I wasn't smart enough to figure out how they were doing it. And we had a commitment desk set up, and our phone number was one digit off from the Ramada Inn reservation line. And the few times that the phone would ring, it would be for some guy wanting to book a hotel room. And we just sat there in the winter of 1984, and it was incredibly tough to just do nothing. And David, if I'm really going to be honest, I'll say the reason I did nothing, even when I was most tempted to match what these market leaders were doing, was because I didn't have the guts to do it. And thank goodness for that.
Yeah, you did.
Because it turned out that the market leaders, they weren't geniuses after all.
Yep.
And, by that summer, it was when American Savings was taken over by the feds. And then a couple of months after that, the Solomon Brothers hedges of those RFC arms blew up. And all of a sudden, our phone was ringing off the hook, and it was all good. So this was an example of a leadership lesson that I learned in retrospect. I didn't understand it at the time, and it was about patience and the willingness to suffer. Suffer the consequences of not following market leaders, which can be really, really tough.
And I think there's a key word distinction there. Market leaders does not equate to being a leader in the industry, because you are actually demonstrating better leadership by being restrained than getting caught up in the madness. And that was true we've seen that played out several times during the subprime crisis and all of that. But this is really one of those first times that I too remember being where it was insane what was going on. And I think that's an important distinction that you shine the light on. Really good.
Yeah, and the thing is this, is that it's true that there's more than one way to go out of business, right? I mean, you can fail from a lack of revenue just as you can fail from taking on too much risk. So it's at the time that you're faced with these kind of decisions, whether it was back in the 80s or whether it was in the last decade when crazy things were going on in the industry, it never seems easy at the time. And you know what? Personally, it can end your career if the board of directors doesn't buy your story about why you're sitting on your hands and the other guys are getting all the business. But if there's one big lesson that we got to take to heart from the meltdown, this is it, right?
Yep, that's exactly right. Well, I think there's been several meltdowns of different varieties and flavors throughout the industry. I'm really interested in getting your perspective because you went more the direction of the secondary markets. You understood them. You were there at some of the earliest developments. Talk about some of that. I think that's a fascinating part of your background.
Yeah,
something
yeah.
that and not everyone that we've interviewed before has had the catbird seat, so to speak, on what was going on.
The 80s were a time when the secondary market went from being all art to becoming more of a science. And the secondary market began really pushing the development of the primary market as well. You know, the next stage of my own career was a big part of that because I went from Sears to I teamed up with a guy by the name of Rick Landau at Dean Witter, and the two of us went and started a jumbo conduit at Bear Stearns. So
yeah.
This is now
what year was
the
that?
Second half of the 80s. This was 1985. So the second half of the 80s is when all of a sudden now the securitization of jumbo loans, which was really what I focused on during the 1980s. The rest of my career was much broader than that, but this was where I kind of initially made my mark. It was also a place where I think it's worth sharing a couple of stories because some of the most profound leadership lessons as I thought back about everything I think about now in this context is what went wrong that led to this cataclysmic meltdown, and what are the leadership lessons that can prevent now we're emerging from that, right?
Right.
Prevent that kind of thing from happening again. So when I went to Bear Stearns, it was back then a super entrepreneurial place, but also extremely disciplined. And the thing that struck anyone, certainly struck me, who showed up there, was that there was a clear culture. You instantly understood what the culture was there, largely created by a really legendary leader, Ace Greenberg, at Bear. And so one of the first days that I was sitting at my desk over there, one of the managing directors walks in, and he reaches into my trash can, and he pulled out a paperclip. And he looked at the paperclip, and he looked at me, and looked back at the paperclip, and he looked at me, put the paperclip down on my desk very carefully like it was made of gold, and he said to me, "You must be a very rich man," and walked out of my office. And that had a profound effect. For one thing, I have never had to, whether corporately or personally, I've never had to buy paperclips again because you find out you can, if you just save all your paperclips that you receive in the mail and whatnot, you have as many as you'll ever need, but here's the thing: this was a culture where you were encouraged to be creative and aggressive and ambitious, and very rarely did anyone waste or spend time on elaborate budgeting processes and whatnot. But it was a culture in which the air you breathed, you knew you never wasted a dime, lost sight of the details. That's how you didn't need the hours and hours and hours of budgeting and whatnot. But maybe even more profoundly relevant for the meltdown is Bear Stearns, the fixed income department was relatively new at that time. It hadn't been around for that long. And it was started by two guys, Billy Michalczyk and Vinnie Mattone. Billy, kind of a small academic-looking guy, Vinnie, like a man mountain, looked like he could have been a mob enforcer, but they're both brilliant and wonderful people. And before coming to Bear, they had been through a amazing and probably somewhat traumatic experience where they had figured out a brilliant trade. They were their own private little firm in the early days of the 1970s of trading the treasury futures. Treasury futures had only just been invented. And they really had a riskless trade, right? When the cash or the futures was rich or cheap, they'd short one and go long the other one. And in theory, no way you could lose money, except there's always a way to lose money because a riskless trade is only riskless if you have infinite capital and you can ride it all the way out. And of course, one day they couldn't ride it all the way out and they went broke. And that was before they showed up at Bear Stearns. And after going broke, they didn't lose their zest for making money. what they did is they learned as leaders to foster, again, a culture, an environment, an air you breathe, where you had this optimal blend of aggression and caution, even sort of a paranoia. So you have aggression. You learn to drive with one foot on the gas and one foot on the brake, and you get to be good at it. You think big, you go for gold, but you have a discipline where risk never gets out of control. And you know what happened to Bear a few decades later could never have happened back then. And the thing is, it was in the culture. So the leadership lesson here is that, you know, it's one thing to have every company has a corporate statement of mission and values and whatnot, but how often do they really mean anything to the rank and file? They're empty. They're words on paper. And the leaders, the real leaders, do what it takes to create a culture where those words take on meaning. And the other thing about this is that leaders learn real lessons from failure. One of the ways I personally
so
took
true.
This part is I was always wary of hiring senior people who had never blundered, who never lost a bunch of money, or I never learned painful lessons from failure.
In fact, that's one of my interview questions when I'm interviewing someone is, tell me about one of your more recent failures and what you learned from it. And it's really interesting when you challenge someone to think about their failures and put it in the context of what you learned. They're insecure getting into that. Why do you think that is? Why is it that we are adverse to want to really discuss where we failed? It seems to be an enemy. Ego is an enemy to leadership.
Well, you know, you're so right about that, David, and it shows up in a number of ways. I mean, you're right. People, of course, have an understandable human aversion to wanting to admit their weaknesses, but the more self, but it comes out of a lack of confidence, and in fact, that what we associate with ego is often really a lack of confidence, the confidence to be able to say, yeah, you know, I did this wrong, and here's what I learned from it, and this is how it's going to work for you. And then, you know, the ego and the lack of confidence has such profound implications for derailing people who could otherwise be good leaders. You know, it can show up in an unwillingness to want to have strong people around you for fear of being overshadowed. It can show up in a unwillingness to give and share credit or even opportunity. And that's pretty much going to guarantee that the only people who you're going to be left with are mediocre. The best people are going to leave, and that ego and which is really born of a lack of confidence. You know, we often associate ego with lots of confidence. That's just deadly for a leader.
As you journey through this, now again, a lot of your experience has been in the capital markets. I think what would be interesting for our young people, again, we're doing a lot of these podcasts for the next generation, and some go to production and some go towards, you know, the various departments. But one of the more intriguing ones, one that's been a bit of a mystery, has been the capital market side, the secondary side. Why is it that you chose to go that direction with your career? Was there any particular driver to that? Is it the way you were wired? Does it take more of an accounting background? What's your thoughts?
Well, it was really a question of where the opportunity was when I first got started. I emphasized the capital markets maybe in the first 10 years of my career, and then after that really was building mortgage companies after that. But early on, In the early 1980s, you know, this was back when you figured out mortgage yields by consulting a little, you know, those little books, right? Those little yield books,
right?
That 12
yes.
year average prepaid life. So it was a time when there was very little sophistication in the business, and I just sort of intuitively sensed that this was the area of great change in the industry, and focused on it for that reason. People often, you know, think of me as being, you know, a quantitatively very talented or something, but I simply wasn't afraid of math, right? And I could see that this was the area of the business where there was opportunity. This was where there was change. And so I got into it, and in fact, the capital markets were really a driver of change. And where there's change,
so true.
There's great opportunity.
That is just so true. I was recently at a meeting and listening to someone talk about Mark Zuckerberg. And Mark has I'm trying to think of the famous photographer that was talking about all the photography he had done. And he said that when you take a picture of Mark Zuckerberg, he was impressed about one poster that was on his wall. First of all, his office is mostly glass cubes, but he had one poster up on the wall that resonated so much of Zuckerberg's attitude. He says, "What would you be willing to do if you had no fear?" And I think is that the right approach? Is that a millennial's approach? And should we be having fear? The financial markets were wrecked. We saw what happened because a lack of respect and fear. Talk about risk. What should we be afraid of? What should we be not fearing?
Well, no, I think it comes back to having the broadest view of risk and what things generate risk and what things generate return. I don't think we can talk intelligently about one without the other. I mean, that's where every great organization, every really exceptionally successful mortgage firm, I'm sure in many industries, has this optimal blend of caution and aggression that I talked about with Bear Stearns. But when I think that now that as the industry is emerging from the deep freeze in the last couple of years, things are obviously getting a lot better. The way that we can think about risk and the way we can think about return is to foster as leaders at any level of the organization to make sure that we're not fostering silos and that we are that different functional areas within a company, whether you're the leader who's got all those functional areas reporting to you, or whether you're the leader of one of those functional areas, we work together as groups. I mean, after all, was the meltdown a function of credit, or was it capital markets, or was it sales? Well, it was all of those things, and in the way that they work together. I think there's so many different aspects of siloed thinking that either creates risk or leads people to make less money. I mean, for example, if I'm the leader of an organization, I'm thinking about the culture. I want to ask, can everyone answer the question, how do we make money around here? What's our value proposition? So if a head of a secondary, for example, a capital markets guy, if he's only thinking about best execution on a micro basis and not global best execution, I, as the leader of this company, I'm not going to get the results that I want. If the way you're making money, your strategy is fostering relationships with certain clients, right? Then you may have to have your secondary guy give up money in the way he's selling loans. And how are your operations and your secondary and your CFO and your salespeople? How are they working together as a group? You gotta have people work together as a group to brainstorm not only about return and how you achieve goals, but about risk itself, because risk crosses all these lines.
I think we look at this industry and the new entrants that are coming in. I think there has to be a healthy fear of what's out there, what can come back and just not only destroy your career or destroy your company or in the great meltdown, nearly destroy global economies. So the global economy. So I look at various ways in which we should be looking at this industry. What are the lessons that you think are most significant that you've learned in your career that we need to be bringing to the next generation?
Well, some of the most important lessons are some of the things that I've been talking about. Right, it's the culture of risk and return. It's building a culture where, for example, you welcome scrutiny. What was if you went back more than 10 years ago, what was the what's the typical attitude, and probably even still today, toward internal audit, to having somebody looking over your shoulder? It's pretty negative, right?
Right.
Whereas what we need is a culture where if you come into a company, you want to feel like, yeah, you know what? I welcome it. Come on, look over my shoulder, because I'm proud of what I'm doing. And then if you have that kind of culture, if you're welcoming scrutiny, if you know that the boss, that the ultimate leader of the company is not just giving lip service to, okay, you know, make a list of possible risks and what are they? And okay, you've done that, cross it off because we were supposed to do that. No, it's a living, breathing part of the culture that you are. If you're going to find yourself waking up at night thinking about risk, you know what? That's okay. You're not just thinking about how do you hit your market share goal, your revenue goal, or whatever. You have made that balance a part of the culture.
What do you think are some of the biggest challenges facing leaders today, based on your experience and your time in the industry?
Well, I think some of them never go away. I don't know if there's unique ones now, but I mean, we have sometimes coming out of an environment like we have, like we've been through, can exacerbate a tendency that some leaders have toward an obsessive micromanagement. And I think that one of the things that we've got to aspire to as leaders is a willingness to be immersed in the details. We've got to know the details, not only just to be effective in shaping the direction of the company, but because it's inspiring to the people below you when they know, hey, yeah, the boss, however many levels up, really gets it, really understands the nitty-gritty of the business. But at the same time, to avoid being micromanagers, because that is, you know, just like the leader who doesn't have the self-confidence to allow people to shine in the spotlight, the micromanager is going to drive away any but the mediocre.
I would agree with that. When you look at what derails managers, would you say the single biggest thing is those that micromanage, or what would you add to that list?
Well, the single biggest thing is that lack of confidence that is so demotivating to the best people who work for you. I mean, What managers, what leaders have to do is to develop a team of stars. Is they've got to be thinking about the people working for them and holding them accountable. You know, if you look at what people do wrong and what they do right as leaders and managers of people, it's not setting the appropriate goals and holding people accountable to those goals, and then where appropriate, pushing people to constantly be developing their own skills, even if that might mean, you know what, that they they're that much more attractive to be taken away from you by one of your competitors. Well, you don't lead out of fear. So many times, managers don't know how or are afraid of holding people accountable, and don't motivate their staff to develop and grow and be as successful as possible.
You have developed and managed a lot of people, and so many people, before I met you and really got to know you, and we're going to talk about the Mortgage Professional Handbook in just a minute, but before I met you, so many talked to you and said, oh, I worked with Jess. I knew Jess, and you were so highly regarded. Why do you think that is? Is it because you nurtured them? Is that the reoccurring theme, Jess, when I talk to those that have known you and worked with you. You seem to nurture them.
Well, I look back and I think of all things that I could have done better, but some of the most gratifying messages that I sometimes get are from former employees who, you know, some of them might have worked for me 20 years ago and you know, thank me for inspiring them to go on and to develop themselves. And I think one of the things is, you know, I got to be a leader very early in my career in the business. And, you know, the higher up you are in the food chain, the easier it is to have a lot of passion and love your job. You're more in control of what you do. You have the big
right.
picture and whatnot. So I think one of the challenges for leaders is, how do you get that passion as much as possible all the way down the organization chart? You know, look, there's always going to be some people who work for you who are just going to show up to pay the rent. But how do you help to instill passion? An example I used to give is that, you know, I could hire someone at a very low level, for example, in another industry and say, your job is to pick white spheroid objects off of a green field, and, you know, here's how I want you to do it, and here, you know, and good luck. The other thing I could say is, you know what, you're going to be the ball boy for the New York Yankees, and we're going to the World Series this year, come hell or high water. And, you know, which employee is going to be more charged up? So I used to spend a lot of time giving, calling groups of different departments, whether accounting department or marketing or IT or whatever, and just talking about the business and what and you know, the basics of how does this work and what are we trying to do and what are we trying to accomplish. And if I was excited about something, I wanted for at least to have them have a chance to understand how they're helping to make that happen and to get excited about it themselves. And that's another part of building culture.
Yeah, culture is creating vision and helping people get excited about what they're being paid to do. But, you know, the person that just says, well, you should be grateful to have a paycheck, I think is missing a big mark. And you certainly did do that. You brought people to a place of where they really got excited. But the number one thing is, you're an educator. You've always wanted to teach. And that's, again, the thing that I keep coming back to that I heard on a reoccurring theme. And you wrote the first Mortgage Professionals Handbook, and that was written what year? Well, I can't remember how long ago that was. But
it was interesting. I was in the 80s, and I was early on in my career, I was very ambitious. I was eager to be a leader in the business. And it was sometime around 86 or 87 that I realized that there was really only one comprehensive book available on mortgage banking back then. And I started putting books together. And actually, I ended up publishing over 40 books on many different aspects of the global financial markets, maybe about a dozen on, or a little more than that, on the mortgage business. And you know, it started out, I'll admit, as about ego and, you know, my own personal ambition. I had a correct intuition that I think also bears on leadership, and that is I chose to make these books anthologies. So each chapter is mostly written by, I'd write some of them, but a lot of different people would write other ones. And of course, on the one hand, that made the books easier to write. But the real advantage is that the books showcased, not only myself, but many of the other talented people in the industry. And, you know, again, it kind of relates to what we were talking about earlier about the way that leaders and managers are successful is by showcasing their own talent. Well, it also applies in this, you know, in other ways as well. So, yeah, I started publishing books in the late 80s and then through the 90s, and then was a hiatus until I had left the business in 2012. But a couple of years ago, I thought, I sort of stayed in touch with people, and I looked up. I was curious. I said, well, you know, the industry's completely changed. We've gone through this cataclysmic meltdown. And I looked, Googled books on mortgage finance. I saw nobody had published anything comprehensive since the meltdown. So that's where it hit me. I've been doing a lot of work in the last 5 or 6 years, raising money for different charities. And I thought, boy, this could be fun to work with 50 of the smartest and most successful people in the business, people like yourself. And we'll all do this, you know, pro bono, and give the profits to charity. There's four terrific charities we've raised over $125,000 for so far.
Wow.
In selling a few thousand these volumes of the handbook, maybe. And, you know, let's create the ultimate post-meltdown reference book. That's what we've done.
And it is so well done, and it's so well written, and I was honored to contribute to it. You invited me to contribute to several chapters. I'm amazed that you write. And you're not technically retired from the retired, but you're out of the mortgage industry, but you're now becoming an author. We're so grateful that you put these handbooks together. And I want, as we wrap up this interview, how can people get these books, and what are you most excited about what people can learn from these books?
Well, To answer what they can learn, I mean, I think they can learn some terrific lessons from the meltdown. You can get a lot of wisdom from people who write about what are the ways, not only how do you make money, but also how do you lose money. What are the ways that you can go broke? But also a lot of just good fundamental basics, right? There's we have the first volume that covers primarily focused on the origination market, as well as some overviews of the industry, and then second volume that focuses on operations and compliance and servicing and whatnot, and the third volume that is secondary market and capital markets. And the way that people can, the most economic way for them is to go to a website that I set up, mortgagebanking2020.com, mortgagebanking2020.com, all one word, obviously. And that's a website that I set up. It's got excerpts from a number of the chapters and information about the terrific charities that we're supporting with this, and a complete list of all of the chapter topics and all of the authors. And that is the most cost-effective way for people. It's also on Amazon, but it's more cost-effective for people to buy it this way.
Yeah, and also the benefits of the charities are the best way. One of my favorite books out there is Givers and Takers. You're definitely one of the givers in the industry. You've given a lot to this industry and given a lot of knowledge and raised up a whole generation of really successful mortgage bankers, and many of who I've become friends with, one of which works with me, and that's Beth Ostinger. She has done a great job. She admires you, and I just want to say thank you so much for taking time. Well, folks, we've had as our guest today on Looking on Leadership, Jess Letterman. It's been a privilege to have him. I encourage you to go out and get these books. Go to the website he just mentioned. We'll put it up in our show notes. I want to just say again, thank you, Jess, for being here with us.
Thank you, David. I appreciated the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to Licking on Leadership, a weekly podcast about leaders in the mortgage industry. Tune in next week, and thanks for listening.